From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, we examine the challenging times for Wisconsin's dairy industry.
Plus, we'll hear about the unique life journey traveled by the CEO of the United Way of Greater Milwaukee in Waukesha County.
Later, we say goodbye to winter with a love letter to a sport that got thousands of people through the cold months, ice fishing.
Okay, kick the stuff to the side a little bit with your boot. Clear the slush away from the hole, and then remember, scraper on the hole, and now do your scooping. There you go. Good job.
And we get a preview of the Florentine Opera's production of The Coronation of Poppea.
Sono rovini amorosi tuoi labbri preziosi. Il mio cuore costa.
Lake Effect is next. News is first.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Over the past 10 years, milk prices have been declining. Amid production increases and waning demand, Wisconsin's dairy farmers are finding themselves in an increasingly difficult predicament. Chapter 12 federal bankruptcy filings have doubled over the past 5 years, as many small farms continue the fight to preserve the state's dairy heritage.
The difficulties facing these farmers are the subject of a new report out today from the Wisconsin Policy Forum. Jason Stein is the forum's research director, and he spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers about the many issues facing farmers today and how Wisconsin compares to other dairy producing states.
Wisconsin's dairy industry is one that, when you compare it to other states around the country, one, we have a very vibrant dairy industry, and we have one that tends to have more smaller producers when you compare it to other dairy states like California. That being said, you have seen this process of consolidation among Wisconsin dairy farms, where the number of cows in the state has really not been changing very much in recent years, but the number of producers has, or dairy herds, has been going down steadily. So what you're seeing is the number of operations in the state is going down, and their size, you know, in terms of the number of cows, is going up.
So what are some of the causes of these changes? Why are we seeing so much consolidation specifically, but also just the loss of these other dairy farms and, you know, as you mentioned in your report, Chapter 12 bankruptcy?
Consolidation is a trend that you've been seeing for many years. But in addition, we've seen other trends that are more worrisome as milk prices has dropped. So in looking at Chapter 12 federal bankruptcy filings in the state, we found a rise. And that's significant because Chapter 12 is a part of the bankruptcy code that is available to family farming operations, also commercial fishing operations, but mainly family farming operations. And we saw that Chapter 12 filings in Wisconsin more than doubled between 2014 and 2017. Now, the number of filings is still a relatively small number, but may well be suggestive of the broader impacts that we are seeing on farms in Wisconsin due to low milk prices and persistently low milk prices.
Yeah, as you mentioned, for about the last 10 years, we've had very low milk prices. And your report actually gets into kind of how milk pricing works, which is pretty confusing. Can you explain that?
So, I mean, first off, just to talk about what we're seeing with prices, prices are down 13% since 2008 and 33% since a recent high in 2014. Now, I mean, probably goes beyond the scope of our discussion here, but milk prices are set by a really complicated process that involves a floor being set by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, as well as market forces of supply and demand. And one thing to think about and keep in mind when you're talking about milk prices and just the reality that dairy farmers face is You know, some types of commodity producers, like grain producers, have an ability to take in a harvest, put it in a silo, and store it at least for some period of time to wait for better prices if need be. For dairy farmers, that's obviously not an option because they have to milk daily. They can't afford to sit on their product for long periods of time or even really short periods of time waiting for a better price. So there are some unique or at least challenging aspects to the business for Wisconsin producers.
Something that you mentioned in the report, cows are producing more milk per animal for a variety of reasons, but demand hasn't been keeping pace. What does demand look like? How has that changed?
So milk prices do respond to supply and demand. So let's talk about both sides of that equation. On the one hand, you are seeing the milk production per cow rising steadily over time. And given the fact that we do have fairly steady numbers of cows, you're seeing an increase in production. So the production per cow went up by more than 13% between August 2012 and August 2018. And the reality is that demand for dairy products overall has not kept pace. So in 2016, the average American consumed 154 pounds of milk, which is down almost 16% from 2010. And, you know, over that same period, Americans did eat somewhat more cheese, about 10% more cheese, but it wasn't, you know, that increase in cheese consumption wasn't enough to make up for the per capita decrease in milk consumption. So that's one of the basic challenges that dairy farms are facing. We also obviously know that they're facing some international trade challenges. That was beyond the scope of this report. But just, you know, in the basic domestic issues, you see some challenges for producers.
Yeah. How much does Wisconsin's economy depend on the dairy industry in general?
If you look at the overall agricultural sector in the state, you know, state and university estimates have put the economic impact of that sector at more than $43 billion a year in total. Now, obviously, that is not solely dairy production, but dairy production is the anchor of that. And it's worth thinking about the whole chain of production in Wisconsin. So obviously you have dairy producers that are buying feed from cash grain producers in the state. They're providing milk to cheese processors. Those cheese processors are then distributing their product to, you know, wholesalers and other buyers. So you have, you know, this whole chain of production that happens in the state, and, you know, product then is shipped out around the country and around the world. So there is a really significant economic impact to the dairy industry. It's worth noting, too, that since 2000, this might surprise some people. I know it somewhat surprised me when I saw the figures. The number of jobs in dairy processing in the state has actually risen, which, you know, is unusual when you look at manufacturing more broadly. Most segments of manufacturing over that period lost jobs. So, you know, that kind of speaks to the importance of having a vibrant dairy industry in the state, and obviously having successful farmers is a crucial part of that.
Yeah, and beyond the economic impact of Wisconsin's dairy industry, our name is America's Dairyland. It is so much a part of our identity.
Sure. If I could, I think you really raise an important point when you talk about the centrality of the dairy industry to the state's cultural identity. And I think beyond that, you can also point out that, you know, the dairy industry is really important in rural Wisconsin. And you know, those are parts of the state that in many cases have faced challenges, you know, and have not necessarily come back as quickly from the Great Recession as some of the urban areas of the state. And so when you think about the challenges of the dairy industry, it's also, I think, important to think about rural communities in general that, you know, may face a host of challenges, you know, from jobs to the fact that with a declining population, you know, their schools have fewer students and, you know, their hospitals, you know, many of their rural institutions may have difficulties sustaining themselves. And so I think it's worth thinking about in this context.
And this is something that has concerned, you know, I think Wisconsinites more generally, but certainly Wisconsin politicians. Governor Walker created the dairy task force, in fact, to deal with the issues that are impacting the dairy industry, in part because it is so important to us culturally.
Sure. And I think this is something from former Governor Walker to the current governor and other members of both parties have expressed concern about this issue, as you would expect. In 2018, then Governor Walker appointed a dairy task force that was a joint effort between state cabinet agencies and the UW system. And the task force has attempted to bring together a variety of stakeholders, so farmers, processors, and consumers, and try to develop proposals aimed at strengthening, you know, the state's dairy industry. They've forwarded, you know, various initiatives to the governor, ranging from loan guarantees to money for dairy research. Obviously, one challenge that they have is just this central issue of milk prices, and we can sort of talk about why that might be a challenge.
Yeah, what really needs to change to ensure that these small farms are kept going?
So I think one of the challenges that, and I wouldn't pretend to at all have the answer to this, but one of the challenges I think you face as a state task force is dairy prices are set by national and even international markets, right? And so the challenge at a state level is, on the one hand, dairy is so important to our state, and so it's, you know, unthinkable, I think, that state officials would look at the problems that are out there and simply wipe their hands. At the same time, it's very difficult at the level of one state to try to make changes that are going to impact markets that go around the country and around the globe. And so I think that is the kind of central challenge and paradox for state officials as they try to grapple with this.
Jason Stein is the research director for the Wisconsin Policy Forum, and he spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. The forum's report on the health of Wisconsin's dairy farms was released today. You can find a link to it at WUWM.com.
We will take a quick break now and then talk with writer Dan Simmons and learn the unique story of the head of the United Way of Greater Milwaukee and Waukesha County. This is Lake Effect for WUWM.
We are back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. The United Way of Greater Milwaukee and Waukesha County funds more than 200 programs at 110 organizations and other program partners around the region.
And while each of those programs has an interesting story, the woman who directs the umbrella organization's effort has a story worth knowing as well.
Dan Simmons profiles Amy Lindner and her life's journey to her current position in a piece in this month's Milwaukee Magazine. Dan, welcome back to the show.
Great to be here. Thanks, Mitch.
So the story of how Amy Lindner ended up with her first job out of college leads this piece. But it is such a remarkable story that I was hoping that you might relate at least the highlights to us, because it really kind of seems to speak to who she is and what she does.
Yeah, so she finished college at UW-Madison. She was pretty convinced that she wanted to go to law school, but she didn't want to dive in both feet until she took some time to truly know that she wanted to go to law school and go into the debt that it requires to go to law school. So she wanted to take a year off, which, you know, for some people who graduate from college, that means, you know, go into be a ski bum or, you know,
people of a certain type would call this a gap year, but...
Right. And so she took a very different route, which is to come back to Waukesha, where she's from. Her family's very important to her. And she heard from a family friend that this auto shop needed a service manager. And so not a traditional fit for a young woman straight out of college with zero auto body or car care experience. But alas, she went in and she talked her way into a job as an office manager at this repair shop. And she killed it. She, you know, was doing things that took the last person, you know, all day and in 2 hours. And so she took it upon herself to actually really study up on car repair, something that was new to her. So she'd go to the library, get books on just – maybe this is sort of before the YouTube era and just read up on – you know, chassis and transmissions. And then she'd go back to the shop itself and talk to the mechanics about what they were doing and sort of translate her book knowledge into real life.
Do you think, is that kind of a metaphor for her approach to everything she's done?
Absolutely. It clearly shows that she can pick up on things, no matter how foreign the topic is to her, very quickly and sort of ingratiate herself into environments that aren't natural fits for her. So, and just kind of the humility it takes to go to someone and say, I don't know anything, but I want to learn and help me out here. She said one important lesson she learned from this experience is that people just love talking about things they care about that are personal to them. And so, you know, she'd ask these mechanics a question and, you know, 3 hours later, no work had gotten done because the mechanic was so so enthused about, you know, sharing his knowledge with her.
I gather the sort of humble upbringing in Waukesha also, you know, keeps her eyes open to the plight of people she sees around her.
Yeah, she grew up as someone who very easily would qualify for programs that United Way sponsors. So she brings that perspective that is obviously very important. I mean, she's the CEO, you know, in charge of this company, but she also, you know, has that knowledge of what it means to struggle and what sort of buttons to push and approaches to take that can lift people out of that situation.
There was one really tiny detail that you mentioned, but it was so evocative. It was like just the kinds of bags that she would carry her grapes to school in.
Yeah, so there were two things, two sort of measures of wealth that she noticed, one of which was some kids had Ziploc bags, you know, with a zipper. And she and her brothers didn't have the Ziploc bags. They had just plain old plastic bags. And the other thing was that some of the kids had grapes all through the winter, whereas they could only have grapes in the summer when they were in season and cheaper. And so that I thought that was just a very telling example of how a kid sees the world in terms of, you know, socioeconomic status.
The other thing that comes through in your reporting is the number of people throughout the community that have acted as mentors to her. And when you think about someone who is now at the position that she's in, the fact that she still calls on these people seems to say something as well.
Yeah, you know, she has risen to a very high position very quickly, but she very much sought out mentors at every stage of her life and found very willing volunteers who still form the kind of the core of her advisory board, for lack of a better word. And now, of course, she's grateful for that experience, and she very much pays it forward to younger people in, you know, her shoes.
Realizing that we really ought to have her on this program and ask her this question, do you get the sense that she sees her path to this position that she's in as kind of remarkable or unusual as it comes across?
Not as remarkable as it seemed to me. I think the more remarkable part for her is that she detoured away from law, because that was what every sign pointed to in her life from early on. Early on, she wanted to be a lawyer because she knew they made a lot of money. And then she later on in life, she realized that the things that lawyers do, she's actually good at and really align with her interest and passions. And so she saw herself as a lifer in corporate law. And did not at all foresee her career taking this direction. But in terms of just how what I would call unlikely and perhaps remarkable her rise from where she started to where she is now, I think she stopped realizing that quite a while ago because, you know, success became just very usual and expected to her.
Well, and it was interesting to see that, you know, she was not the only person that gave up a corporate law job to pursue a career in the nonprofit world. And you know, these are people that that she had contact with then and maintains contact with now.
Yeah. So in particular, Ann Reed, who was her mentor at the law firm, made the transition to CEO of the Humane Society. And so she was kind of a natural fit as a model and a mentor in both roles.
Well, Dan Simmons, interesting piece. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Mitch.
Writer Dan Simmons' profile of Amy Lindner, the president and CEO of the United Way of Greater Milwaukee and Waukesha County, is in the current issue of Milwaukee Magazine. You'll find a link to more at WUWM.com.
Another break now, and then with spring into its first full day, we will look back at winter and find out what made some people embrace rather than endure the months of cold. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. The vernal equinox happened just before 5 o'clock yesterday afternoon in the Central Time Zone. For the next 6 months, sunlight will represent a majority of our days, which have been getting warmer of late.
And while that is welcome news, contributor Debbie McCullough will be a little conflicted about winter's demise. That's because the New Zealand transplant and her family picked up a new hobby over this past winter, ice fishing. That means she is now among the reported 460,000 people in Wisconsin who at least occasionally practice the sport. So as we enjoy the first full day of spring, McCullough relates what appeals to so many people about a day on a frozen lake.
It's a brisk Wisconsin Saturday. Temperatures are hovering in the single digits, and given the breezes, it's chilly even to those used to the coldest winters. But you wouldn't know these conditions in Muskego, a half hour south of Milwaukee. Across the iced over Big Muskego Lake, ice fishermen, children and women are stationed as far as the eye can see. Some drill holes with augers, others cheerfully attach minnows to fish hooks and then hunker down inside their tents with a smile and a fishing pole. Mike Richardson and his grandson, Clayton Ziske, have been coming out to Big Muskego's Boxhorn Access for years. Richardson views ice fishing as a grand tradition and an easy winter sport, getting the kids outside and off tech. Incentives like peanut butter and jelly sandwiches and hot chocolate help. Richardson walks us through the setup, which includes drilling holes in the ice, setting up a tent, and putting bait on a hook.
We were drilling holes and making sure the water was deep enough here, and pretty soon I'm gonna drill another hole right here, and he's gonna be fishing with one of these.
Part of the joy for this group comes from getting the children involved. Richardson gets his grandson to work digging out the chunks of ice from the hole.
Because if the rod gets stuck on the ice,
it won't go down, will it?
Yeah.
What won't go down?
His bait won't go down.
And then it'll get stuck on the side of the... Oh, geez, the ice is pretty thick.
I know. How thick you think it is? 10 or 12 inches?
Pretty much, yeah.
It's only like 16 below out here today.
Is that not good temperature? What's the best temperature?
Well, there's ice. We don't care.
While the temperatures and lake are frozen, ice fishing keeps you warm because of the shelter that comes with the sport. Clayton's brother, Al Ziske, fishes from a pup tent. Al says he's been fishing with his dad and grandfather for about 5 years and looks forward to the sport each winter. With the grandsons bundled up in full winter coat, boots and gloves, nobody's complaining of the cold.
Right there.
A little propane ceramic heater.
Oh.
Can you feel the heat coming out of there on your face?
Other families joined Richardson and his grandson that day, like the Beefus family. John Beefus is setting up the tent, getting the heat rolling, while his boys drill the holes with their auger.
Oh, we got a nice shanty. It fits all seven of us in there. And then we got another five or six tip downs and got about four or five tip ups. And then we got some jigging poles that will sit inside the shanty and watch the tip ups and tip downs and jig for little guys. So.
And what does a successful day look like when you're an ice fisher person?
Oh, as long as we're out here, it beats any day at work, that's for sure.
Like Richardson, Beefus says the joy doesn't come from catching the fish per se. It's more about being out in nature with his five kids. In the 5 years he's ice fished, he's had big catches, like 30 to 40 inch northern. The Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources tracks catches. Nearly half of all fish caught are kept versus one third during open water season. And that's mostly panfish, followed by northern pike and walleyes.
It's more or less just the fun of catching them, bringing out the fish through the ice with the kids, and they just have a blast with it.
Ice fishing also provides an education. Inside their tent, John's brother, Josh Beefus, and his boys learn to drill 10-inch deep, 8-inch wide holes with a hand auger to break the ice. The boys scoop out the ice so the fishermen see a clear hole. You can drill multiple holes, provided each is a foot or so apart. A sunflower mister heater keeps the tent, with a floor so the ice beneath them doesn't melt, toasty and warm. The adult men get minnows and waxworms ready to bait the fish up through the hole.
Okay, kick the stuff to the side a little bit with your boot. Clear the slush away from the hole, and then remember, scraper on the hole, and now do your scooping. There you go. Good job.
Another appeal for fishermen like the Beefus family is keeping their fishing tradition alive and exploring new toys and techniques.
This is just the Strike Master Mora. It's a hand auger, and it has a drill adapter on it, so you can put a hand drill on it instead of a gas auger. It works pretty well. It's first time trying it, and seems like it works pretty good.
Adam Young is a recreation specialist for the city of Muskego. His work includes hosting community events to get youth interested in winter sports. He suspects the popularity of ice fishing will only rise given the growing ease of entry into the sport. There are lots of accessible lakes in the Midwest. The cost of a license is low, and basic equipment is inexpensive as well, though you can easily spend a lot if you're so inclined.
You're going to need to get through the ice, for one, so you can go ahead and buy a cheap hand auger if you want, anywhere between $20 and $75. But, you know, the electric augers that they make now, you're looking at anywhere between $400 and $600. Really, all that you would need is to be able to get through the ice and a fishing pole. You can get out for pretty cheap.
Ice fishing also provides an opportunity for socializing outdoors and time to drink. Muskego resident and Youth Warriors football coach Kevin Grisius hosts an annual ice fishing shanty party from Bass Bay, part of the Big Muskego Lake. This year marked his seventh consecutive shanty party, and each year he finds more joining them to enjoy their outdoors and to be social. Grisius built his shanty from his garage one winter with his 11-year-old son, Sean.
7 years ago, we built my permanent shanty with the wood burner and decided to invite a bunch of people over to do some ice fishing, have some food, and maybe a couple of beverages.
So the shanty is the name of the structure. What have you made that with?
It's all 2x2 wooden framework and then just 1/4-inch OSB plywood for the sides and for the roof, and then a wood burner inside for some heat.
The heat and the structure provides a big pull for friends and family to come out.
A lot of people come out because of the shanty, just because there's room for everybody to sit down and be warm, whereas the tents usually fit 3 or 4 at the most.
So how many can we fit in your shanty there?
I've had 12 in there, and it's right now probably like 80 degrees in there.
For this year's Shanty Fest, 30 or so folks came out. We're talking quite a scene. A neighbour named Mr. Mike pulls kids on toboggans from his four-wheeler. Others ice skate, explore, and fish. Inside the steamy shanty, friends enjoy a beverage, the heat, and reflect on the event's history chronicled in writing on the walls.
Shanty Fest is usually pretty bad.
Yeah.
But you caught keep
the,
coming
I caught
back.
The old yeah, like,
Shanty Fest 2018, one fish caught.
Well, last year was a slow year, but it's been
And while catching fish doesn't feel like a priority for shanty parties, the thrill when the fish bite becomes huge. At the Shanty Fest, the revelers catch a total 13 bass and perch, a record for the event. The excitement starts with a flag up, signalling the fish had pulled on the bait. Everyone gathers around. The men check the hook and wait.
Oh my gosh, let's get a picture.
Grisius says he never learned ice fishing as a boy, but he taught himself out of a need to make winter and the long, cool days outdoors interesting. And the highlights of ice fishing become meaningful for him.
For me personally, it was all the time I've spent with my son on the ice and hanging out with family and friends and just having a good time.
The sport itself is easy, he says. Anyone can do it. Optimum feeding time becomes early morning and evening, but really any time, and until the ice starts to melt come April is good.
And just a your run-of-the-mill beaver dam tip-up system, set your depth, set your bait, flag goes up, catch the fish.
So part of the strategy is just keeping an eye out on those flags?
Yep, just watch for your flags to be standing up, and it's kind of like bobber fishing in the winter.
And what's the biggest fish you've caught when you've been out here?
Depends on the species. The biggest bass I caught was about 23, 24-inch largemouth. That was a really nice fish. Otherwise, pike, like 32, 33-incher, nothing really impressive, but they're still nice, fun to catch.
The big takeaway for this newcomer to ice fishing was gaining extended time in the fresh air in spite of the extreme cold. The effects of the air, sun, and social activity lasted for days. In this family, now on our second Wisconsin year, our perspective on winter had shifted. Adam Young with the City of Muskego says his goal is to help more children and their families experience the joy of angling for that very reason.
You definitely try and, you know, make it as fun as possible, but you have to have creative ways on getting through the winter months in the Midwest, in my opinion. And once you, I guess, embrace the winter activities, you're going to have a much better time.
The only caution around angling is that you remain on ice. And with that, some danger exists. You must learn to read the ice. Melting snow cover can cause you to sink into wet sludge. To stay safe, Young says, stay with the flock.
You're going to have your seasoned veterans that know the lakes that they fish well. So I kind of put my faith into, you know, the people that I see on the ice with their vehicles already, that it's safe, you know.
And of course, Young reminds us that ice is slippery. During the ice fishing shanty party, most revelers fell at least once. All that aside, Young agrees ice fishing stays a fairly safe sport, and that's why it's so popular, even with young Wisconsinites. It's remained a staple in Young's life since he held a fishing pole as a tot. And like this newcomer to the state, he still views the sport as a great way to embrace versus resist the winter months.
For me, it's all about taking in what we have available to us in the Midwest. Sometimes we take it for granted, you know, where we always wish, you know, to be on the beach in the wintertime. But when you can embrace what we have up here, it's going to just make it that much more fun. And once you get to that point, you just want to keep going out.
For Lake Effect, this is Debbie McCullough reporting from Muskego, Wisconsin.
The snow lay up against the curb, finally beaten by the sun. Across the street, a noon whistle blow, calling back. Come out from the lunch and dance.
Contributor Debbie McCullough is a New Zealand transplant who now lives in southeastern Wisconsin. You can see photos and hear her previous stories of getting to know the Midwest at WUWM.com.
One more break now, and then three of the artists involved in the Florentine Opera's new production offer us a preview. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR.
Ice is cracked on the river, rolling out to the bay. On one floor rides a bomb house. There's always one who stays out too long, they say.
Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. When we think of modern opera, we think of names such as Puccini and Wagner and even Mozart. But opera, the way we know it, can trace its lineage back to the Venetian composer Claudio Monteverdi. Among Monteverdi's works are Orfeo and this weekend's program by the Florentine Opera, The Coronation of Poppea.
The production at Vogel Hall is on stage this weekend and next. And joining us at the Florentine Opera's rehearsal space in River West are stage director Robin Guarino, harpsichordist and conductor Jory Vinokur, and Grammy Award-winning tenor Karim Suleiman, who will sing the role of Emperor Nero, to talk about the production.
This opera is about relationships and power and ambition and politics, and it centers around the Emperor Nero and his complicated and unhappy relationship with his sister, stepsister, Ottavia, who is the Empress, and a series of his relationships, mainly in this story, Poppea. The reason it's relevant is because these are fully fleshed out human beings, and their naked wants and desires and ambitions are there for us to see. But I think also deep in the center of Poppea is the question of how do you live, how do you rule, and as is sort of focused on in the relationship between Nero and Seneca, where he says, you know, people just don't behave like this, and there are ethical principles, and there are rules, and they're there for a reason, and they ground and root the government. And Nero basically says, I make the rules, and then I break the rules, and I do whatever I want. And I think that there are relevancies that we can all, you know, think about in relationship to that. And then once he crosses the line and has, spoiler alert, Seneca assassinated, chaos has come again. And that's the sort of the beginning of the spiral out of Nero.
And this is the Nero fiddling while Rome burns.
Yes.
Yes. And so operatically, I mean, this is Monteverdi. It's very early in the Western canon. Is it one of the earliest, Jory?
Yeah, so the so-called Florentine Camerata, and from which this very opera company took its name nearly a century ago, the Florentine Camerata was a group of musicians, principally Monteverdi, Jacopo Peri, I think Giulio Caccini, discussing about how to bring together text and music in something which resembled the Greek classics. And as I recall, the very first so-called opera, and this didn't hold the name opera, but again, music, drama, wed together, was Peri's Eurydice and Monteverdi's Orfeo, which is wonderful. Karim toured the country singing the title role this past year. You know, this tells a mythological story. Poppea is the last of Monteverdi's surviving operas, and is partially unusual in that Monteverdi does not take mythological figures and mythological stories, but a very doctored version of Roman history, so involving the Emperor Nero, his courtesan wife Poppea, as well as the philosopher Seneca, who should have been the moral backbone of that rule.
You almost don't need the mythical figures. This is so... No. Almost mythic in all of the stuff that was
of
happening.
Course. Bigger
and the
than
relationship,
life.
Bigger than life.
Bigger
yeah.
than life persons.
And as we were doing the work through last night in the room, I was really taken by how vivid and in time the drama and the action were. I mean, people are so connected to the text, and it is as it's like contemporary drama. It's just so relevant, both stylistically and in terms of the drama and how riveting and scary. You were, by the way, Kareem.
So, yeah. Kareem, do you feel that way at being in it, that this is like immediate and relevant?
Yeah, definitely. It's so real in a way. I think what Monteverdi does so well is, I mean, he just makes these characters so grounded in reality with his marriage of sound and text. And so these characters are insane. Don't get me wrong, but
But our lighting designer, Mary Eleanor Stebbins, said last night, you know, it's really interesting to watch the drama that's happening and then ask the question, is this real? Or are we seeing what someone else is thinking? Or are we seeing what they're feeling or thinking inside? And that, I think, is also Monteverdi's genius, is that at some points in the drama, you are watching their internal subtext and their emotional subtext, and it switches really seamlessly from that.
And we think of that as being so contemporaneous, that that's what we do now, that that's a modern thing in theater and opera. And here he was doing
it. But also in reality, because sometimes, frankly, I turn on the news and I'm like, is this real? You know, so, you know, like certain things are like, you don't even know anymore. And I think what this opera gets at is we don't really know. We only know at the moment how to act. And I think having power challenges how we use it, if that makes any sense.
No, totally. I was thinking of Clemenza di Tito, another great Mozart opera that takes place in Rome that really asks the questions, how does one lead? And how does one lead a country? And you know, what is the scaffolding for, you know, to contain behavior and, you know, the challenges of leading people?
Yeah, and I think something that I'm learning is that, you know, it's very complicated, you know, learning with this character. And I did a lot of reading and, you know, we were discussing how much of the actual history of Nero and his time in the Roman Empire do we use and all of that stuff. But in the reading that I was doing, it just became clear that he wasn't completely awful all the time. He was raised in an awful way. Mm-hmm. And I think when you're raised in an awful way with awful people around you and just awful things happening all the time, it's impossible not to then be very complicated and screwed up
as
certainly you grow.
The version of Nero and Caligula and other rulers known to Renaissance Italy was a possibly exaggerated or heightened version of their decadence, but even the reality would have not been very flattering.
Yeah.
Right. You were doing Orfeo. Now, Orfeo was early. Was that the first? Is that considered
that
the first one?
That was his first one.
First one.
16.
And so,
16. Was that?
And we can. Something. We consider that the first modern Western opera, don't we?
It's certainly the first that's done with any regularity.
Yeah.
Today.
Right.
Yeah.
It's not the very first opera. Again, I think it's the Eurydice, which is same myth.
But it's arguably the best.
Yeah.
That time.
I mean, it might be the best one.
How many years between Orfeo and Poppea?
We're nearly 30.
Yeah.
Musically, what is different for you singing? Because you've just sung the Orfeo and now you're singing Nero.
Poppea is a lot more recit.
And a lot more story-driven.
Enough. Yeah. I mean, Orfeo, you have an extended 8-minute aria that is very, like, melodic, florid, and beautiful. And there's nothing like that in Poppea. There's a lot of dialogue. There's a lot of very direct delivery of text, which is also in Orfeo. It's in all of these things, but there is a real movement towards direct drama in Poppea.
Interesting. And in that 30 years, that changed?
I don't know that entirely changed. I think this is Monteverdi's viewpoint on telling a very current story and telling the mythological one. And possibly the 8-minute aria that Kareem is evoking is this Possente Spirite. So when Orpheus descends into the underworld to plead for Eurydice, and it's even more fascinating than he just said, not only florid and complicated, but each verse accompanied by different instruments. So there's a pair of cornetti at one point with their own extraordinary writing. There's a triple harp during another verse. There's a pair of violins in one. So all of this is so incredibly novel. And by the time he gets to Poppea, the novelty of opera was a little bit less, and he could concentrate on the storytelling. And yet we have incredibly melodic moments.
Oh, sure. For sure. I didn't mean to say like there's nothing like that,
no.
But you're not going to get an 8-minute aria in this piece.
No. So. I was going to say, what we're about to hear is what? Only a couple of minutes long.
Yeah, if that, yeah. Yeah. Or maybe, yeah, maybe a couple
so,
minutes.
You know, I don't know if I'm just being difficult, as I always like to do. In fact, Poppaea really does start with an 8-minute aria for Ottone, for the character of Ottone, who comes back. We snip it down to size a little bit, but the full thing
would have
been
8 minutes.
Yes.
Yeah. But
yes,
you don't get to sing that because that's not true.
No,
part.
So who cares?
Yeah, exactly.
No, I'm just kidding. It's very beautifully sung by Nicholas Tamani.
No, but I wanted to just say, I think the version that we're doing, Thank You, Yori, is just beautiful.
It is.
And it's very special and has its debut at the Florentine. Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I think everybody has their own version of this. Very few theaters can afford to present Poppaea absolutely complete with no cuts. And it's very unclear what that version is.
The urtext of that, yeah. I mean,
very,
exactly.
Very difficult. I mean, we have these books with hundreds of pages of appendix to indicate these. So with the great help of Stephen Stubbs, wonderful conductor, theorbo player, I have done other changes and edits to our version.
You've made your version of it.
Kind of, sort of,
yeah,
yes.
Kind of, sort of. Well, let's hear some music. And Kareem, would you tell me what we're about to hear, where you are, who you're singing to?
Sure. It's called Son Rubin Amorosi, which means, I mean, he says in the first line, your lips are like precious rubies. And it's Nero singing to his favorite court poet, Lucano. And they've just had an incredible florid duet of two tenors. It's definitely suggestive, homoerotic, and Nero then sings this piece with Lucano on stage, and it is unclear if he's singing to Poppaea or to Lucano at that point. But
it should be said that it starts Act Two.
After it does start our
after
Act
the death
two,
of
yes.
Seneca.
Yes.
So it comes out of a rousing dance number.
It does. So Robin wrote to me months and months ago saying, do you have an idea for a wonderful instrumental piece that could precede the Lucano Nero scene? And I thought of a wonderful Ciacconna for two violins by Tarquinio Merula, just probably a decade at the most after this opera.
So you merged
that
in.
We have some carousing going about during this Ciacconna, mm-hmm. Some drunken reveling. And I think I'm not ruining anything just to say that of the drunken reveling, Lucano, played by Nick Huff,
yeah.
Comes out the winner for the moment in this and then ends up singing with Nero.
Then let's hear it.
Con rudini amorosi tuoi labbri preziosi, il mio cuore costante di saldo diamante, così, così le tue bellezze il mio cuore. Di care gemme ha fabbricato amore, di care gemme ha fabbricato amore. Sono rose senza spine le guance tue divine, ciglie ligustri eccede il candor di mia fede. Così tra il tuo bel viso ed il mio cuore la primavera sua tua divide amore, la primavera sua, la primavera sua divide amore, divide amore.
One of the things that I love about Baroque singing, the tone tends to be, to my ear, rounder and less, maybe less vibrato.
Well, I think what this music gives us as interpreters is the ability to choose how to use our voice, which is, there's a lot in the text that can dictate to us as actors then what colors we can bring out. And I think vibrato, you know, if you have the technique to control your vibrato and to make it less or make it more, if you have the ability to do that, then the magic that we can make is to then paint different colors with the score. And I think that that's what makes this music so interesting. That's what makes then these dramas so interesting, is that it becomes less about our voices and more about storytelling.
This is not my first time together working with Karim. And interestingly enough, we worked together on a world premiere of a new American opera at Houston Grand Opera, where he was an opera about the Rothko Chapel by the composer Laura Kaminsky. Totally different from this.
Very
completely
different.
Completely different. But I think the two of us really live in between, you know, the 21st century and, you know, the 17th century.
Yes.
And the same thing you were able to do communicating the text with your amazing full spectrum of color toolbox, you know, and what you're able to bring in to the words and communicating to the words is fantastic.
Well, thanks. But I think, thank you. but I think what makes it also interesting is to be able to do something different with what these composers, I mean, these are masterpieces. And I think that if you bring a mind to it to really bring things to life, then it's there for us to do, you know?
Well, yeah,
and it's exciting to use, for me, it's exciting to use my voice as that kind of instrument and not as just something to be like, listen to how great I sound, which is also amazing to go to something like La Boheme and to hear a soprano sing Donde Lieta and bring, every single time I see Boheme, I am in tears in Act Three. And that is another thing, you know, that's another thing that is so special about opera. But this is different, you know, and this is what I like to do.
The Florentine Opera's production of The Coronation of Poppea is on stage this Friday and Sunday and next Saturday and Sunday at Vogel Hall. We visited with stage director Robin Guarino, harpsichordist and conductor Jory Vinokur, and Grammy Award-winning tenor Karim Suleiman, who will sing the role of Emperor Nero. Jason Reavy produced our field recording. That is all for today's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect. It's here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Keep listening. It's 11 o'clock and fresh air is next.